Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 7, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing what we are learning about for-profit education. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are pleased to have with us Lucas Townsend, who is a partner at Gibson Dunn. I will turn it over to Lucas to get us started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us. Lucas, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Nate. As Nate mentioned, I'm Lucas Townsend. I am a litigator in the Washington, D.C. office of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. And by way of background, I do a great deal of administrative law work across agencies, but in recent years I've done a particular focus on education sector work, and in particular work with the proprietary schools of higher education or for-profit schools. And it's been a very challenging last 8 years for the sector, and actually now we're entering into a period where there's a tremendous amount of tectonic change for the sector. And so the topic of today's conversation is very timely. We're going to be looking at some of the regulations that applied not just to for-profit schools, but had a particular effect on for-profit schools that issued in the last administration, in the Obama administration, and what can be done, what the sector can do about some of these very onerous rules and regulations in the beginning of the Trump administration. So I'm going to talk just by way of introduction and an overview. I'm going to talk today specifically about four regulations that issued in the Obama administration, then we'll get into some of the provisions of those regulations and what is being done currently and what can be done about those rules and regulations. The first one, I'm going to go in reverse chronological order here. The first one is actually one that issued very late in the Obama administration. It's called the State Authorization Rule. And at a very high level, what it does is it requires online education programs to be authorized in every state in which students are enrolled in the program. The final rule was published on December 19th, 2016. It actually doesn't become effective until July 1st, 2018. The next one that we'll discuss is actually one of the two very big ones that came out of the last administration, the Borrower Defense to Repayment Rule. And at a very high level, what it does is it creates new mechanisms for students to seek discharge of their Title IV loans and to hold schools liable for that discharge. It really does apply to all schools, but it would apply most severely to for-profit schools. The final rule was published on November 1st, 2016, and barring any intervening action, which I think is probably likely, it will become effective on July 1st, 2017. The next rule is also probably the one that may be best familiar to the entire audience. It's the Gainful Employment Regulation. And again, at a very high level, that regulation conditions access to Title IV funding on whether students earn, essentially, whether they earn enough money in their occupations to pay back their student loans. That's at a very high level, what the rule purports to do. The rule became final on October 31st, 2014. And it was challenged in litigation. APSCU is the trade association for proprietary schools of higher education. It brought an APA challenge, essentially that wended its way up to the Court of Appeals, and the D.C. Circuit upheld a rejection of the challenge as of March 8, 2016, so last year. So that rule is now final, it's in effect, and schools are complying. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. And then finally, the first-in-time rule, which came out fairly early in the Obama administration, is the incentive compensation rule. And that rule essentially forbids compensating college recruiters based on the number of students that the recruiter enrolls. And I say enrolls as distinct from the number of students who graduate or complete their programs of study. So the final rule was published on October 29th, 2010, and it was the subject of a successful legal challenge, actually two successful legal challenges by ABSCU, which ultimately led the Department of Education to reinterpret its rule in 2015 so as not to prohibit recruiters, compensating recruiters based on the students' graduation rates, graduation from or completion of their educational programs. So those are the four rules that we'll talk about, and they have been kind of the signature rules out of the Obama administration. The first two that I mentioned, the state authorization rule and the borrower defense to repayment rule, both of those were issued late last year. And so that raises an interesting option for addressing these rules going forward. And the option lies in the Congressional Review Act. The Congressional Review Act, essentially what it does is it creates a 60-day window, regulations that are submitted to Congress within 60 days of the end of the congressional term are subject to a vote of a resolution of disapproval by the next Congress. And I say 60 days, there's actually a complicated way of calculating those 60 days. It's actually 60 legislative days rather than calendar days. So actually, if you do the math, rules that were submitted to Congress on or after June 13th, 2016 would be subject to a new review period in the current 115th Congress. The Congressional Review Act it's a very interesting statute that was enacted in 1996 and has only been used successfully once before. I believe it was in 2001, and it was used to withdraw or to disapprove an ergonomics rule by OSHA. And that was the only time until very recently that the statute has been used successfully, but we actually now see a fair amount of activity in Congress under the Congressional Review Act. So this raises an opportunity for addressing the most recent regulations in the new Congress. So just to go back to the rules that I had mentioned, we'll start out with the state authorization rule, which, as I mentioned, is not effective until July 1st, 2018. And, this rule has not received a lot of press, in my opinion, and I think that's partly because its effective date is so far in the future, and also because I think there is probably an expectation with the change of administration that something's going to happen to overtake this rule. But if the rule had come down at any other time, I think it would actually be quite problematic for the sector, and I think you would see quite a lot of concern with what this rule purports to do. The rule requires schools that receive Title IV funds for post-secondary online programs to be authorized in each state in which a student is enrolled, provided that the state itself requires authorization. So traditionally, online schools needed only to be authorized only in the states in which they had a physical presence. You can imagine that if you are a small school that has an online program and you have students across the country who are enrolled in that program, suddenly you go from one state regulating you to 50 or potentially 50 states regulating you. And this is, and so that's 50, not just 50 authorization procedures, but 50 states that have their own consumer protection laws, their own attorneys general who have views about what those consumer protection laws require. So it really does, in theory, introduce a great deal of additional regulation and compliance burden for online schools. The rule provides that schools may enter into reciprocity agreements, provided that they allow participating states in those agreements to enforce their own statutes and regulations. So again, the rule is very very skewed toward every state in which students are enrolled having some regulatory control over the school. And in addition, the rule provides that schools must provide extensive, very extensive public and individual disclosures for distance and correspondence programs. So the public disclosures, just by way of example, that would be required are whether the institution, the school would have to disclose whether the institution is authorized by the state in which the enrolled student resides, and whether it is authorized through a reciprocity agreement. We'd also have to disclose the consequences of the student moving to a state where the institution is not authorized. It would have to disclose how to submit complaints with the appropriate state regulators, any state enforcement actions against the online program in the preceding 5 years, any adverse action by the school's accrediting agency against the online program. It would have to disclose refund policies, state licensure requirements for the occupation, and also state licensure requirements for the occupation that is the subject of the online program. So all of these disclosures, would represent potential liability and risk for online schools, and multiply that by 50 or by the number of states in which the online program is available, and it is a tremendous amount of additional regulation. In addition, there would have to be individual disclosures that would be made to prospective and enrolled students, including, among other disclosures, any determination by the institution, by the state, or by the accreditor that the program does not meet licensure or certification requirements, and any adverse actions initiated by the state or by the accreditor. And what we have seen in recent years is we've seen states become very active in bringing actions against schools, and in particular, proprietary schools of higher education. So it's something that would, in theory, be a very kind of very a point of leverage over schools. If there is any sort of an enforcement or regulatory state regulatory action, it would result in disclosures, which would in turn have a very negative effect on the schools continuing to operate. So these are just some of the provisions in this state disclosure rule. The chief criticism, as you can imagine, is that the rule imposes additional and very onerous burdens on proprietary schools of higher education. Every state has different authorization requirements, and it's certainly conceivable that online programs can have regulation from 50 different states. And this compliance cost can be prohibitive, especially for smaller schools. So there is an inherent bias in the regulation itself in favor of larger schools that could actually manage this compliance burden. There are also concerns that the rule would exceed the department's authority under the Higher Education Act. So the current status of this rule, apparently no legal challenges that I've seen have been filed. And I think that's consistent with the current environment, which is a very much a wait-and-see type environment. I think the sector is expecting the new administration to really take action that will overtake a number of these rules, including the state authorization rule. According to some reporting recently by Inside Higher Ed, Virginia Fox, who is the chairwoman of the House Committee on Education and the Workforce, has specifically identified this rule, the state authorization rule, as one of the, quote, onerous rules and regulations, end quote, that the congressional Republicans are looking to, quote, deal with. And the reporting that I saw wasn't any more specific than that, but it does suggest that the rule has come to the attention of members of Congress, leaders of Congress, who are in a position to deal with this rule in some way, either through the Congressional Review Act or through the Higher Education Act reauthorization or some other activity. So just my kind of high-level predictions on what might happen next. As I said, the rule hasn't received as much attention as the Defense to Repayment Rule, which I'll discuss next, or the gainful employment rule, but there have been calls to deal with this rule. And I think the challenge really is going to be to have this rule elevated to, particularly if we're talking about the Congressional Review Act, the challenge will be to have this rule elevated to Congress's attention. There's quite a bit that of business that's on Congress's plate right now, including a number of other rules that are quite problematic in other contexts. So to get this rule to the level of actually a resolution of disapproval is the real challenge here. I've seen some reporting that suggests that maybe a half dozen rules or so are going to be actually teed up for the Congressional Review Act. Although I think, just last week we saw five resolutions of disapproval come out of Congress. I think we'll have to wait and see whether this state authorization rule will actually be the subject of review under the Congressional Review Act. If not, I think it's probably something that's likely to be addressed in a future reauthorization of the Higher Education Act. So just to get to move on to the next rule, the Borrower Defense to Repayment Rule, this is really one of the biggest rules of the Obama administration in the education sector, and it becomes effective on July 1st, 2017. Quite a detailed rule. There's really a lot to discuss, and I can only give a very high-level overview. But the rule prohibits schools, one of the things that it does is it prohibits schools from entering into pre-dispute arbitration agreements with borrowers or requiring class action waivers. And, these are fairly common in the education sector among proprietary schools and non-proprietary schools. So it's a pretty bold step in this regulation and very controversial. The rule would also allow students and graduates to assert a defense to future repayment of their Title IV loans, and in some circumstances, even to recover amounts that were already paid on those loans. And this would be based on certain defenses, such as the rule provides a non-default favorable contested judgment against the school based on any state or federal law. So imagine a tort judgment for misrepresentation or for some state law tort, that could be the basis for a defense to repayment. Also, the school's failure to perform its obligations under the terms of a contract with the student. So I think a breach of contract. And perhaps most controversially, it would provide a defense to repayment based on a, quote, substantial misrepresentation, end quote, by the school, by its representatives, or by agents that the borrower reasonably relied on to the borrower's detriment when the borrower decided to attend or to continue attending the school or decided to take out a direct loan. And the rule actually provides a definition of a substantial misrepresentation that, as you can imagine, is very malleable and frankly subjective. So this has caused a great deal of concern. And again, not just in the proprietary sector, but it's pretty clear that this rule is geared mainly toward the proprietary sector. The Department of Education can adjudicate these borrower defenses on a group basis. So it's an agency proceeding, and you think of something that's similar to a class action, but within the Department of Education and lacking due process, and that's essentially what you have in these group adjudications. And any private school can trigger a requirement that they post additional security or financial guarantees against future defenses for repayment. And this triggering mechanism is also something that's very problematic and very concerning for schools. The rule creates a number of automatic triggers and discretionary triggers for these heightened security requirements. So, for example, an enforcement action brought by any state or federal authority or a private lawsuit that has survived summary judgment, these can trigger the Department of Education requiring schools to post additional security against future defenses to repayment. And if you think about what has happened in the sector in recent years, these additional security postings have actually been a death knell, or in some cases a death knell. They've been very problematic for schools. If you are a school that is in the throes of litigation and you suddenly get a requirement that is to post more capital with more security with the Department of Education, that can be quite an onerous thing for a school. It may require taking more loans, and it can kind of lead to a spiral for many schools. So this is a very troubling provision in this defense to repayment rule. And in addition, the rule requires schools to make certain disclosures when triggering events occur. And proprietary schools with poor loan repayment rates are required to place warnings in advertisements and promotional materials. And for this purpose, the rule uses the gainful employment rate calculation. So it really is, this rule is, from the perspective of the proprietary sector, it's just sort of a grab bag of bad ideas and dangerous ideas for the sector, and something that I think is very very much in the minds of the sector and in the beginning days of the new administration. I think the sector would very much like to see something done about this rule. The chief criticisms, I think are apparent. The rule's very vague and malleable standards for substantial misrepresentation will just lead to an explosion of claims by students seeking to shed their student loan debt. At least this is, the criticism that has been, this is the fear that many schools have. And when that happens, if the school is no longer in business because it's had to post more capital than it's able to post or for other reasons, who pays for the student loan disclosure? Taxpayers. For the student loan discharge, taxpayers would pay for that. So this has the potential to be a very expensive rule also. I think there's also a concern that because some of these triggers are tied to state action by state attorneys general, for instance, and some states have been very aggressive and have brought very politicized enforcement actions against certain schools, that is something that states can actually use as a way of really pressuring schools, not outside the borders of the state. They can just bring an enforcement action within the state and cause all sorts of problems for the school with the Department of Education. And I think this has been a concern as well. And that just generally the rule is heavily skewed against the proprietary sector, and the concern is that this rule is really just a reflection of the Obama administration's general hostility toward this sector. So the current status, as far as I can see, no challenges have been filed yet, no legal challenges, but it is, again, one of these rules that I think is very much the expectation is that we're going to see some activity in the new administration. It does seem likely that with a rule of this magnitude, some action is going to be taken either by the Congress or by the Trump administration. And there are a number of options that could happen. Congress could disapprove this regulation under the Congressional Review Act. It could attempt to defund the regulation, or it could attempt to address it in the Higher Education Act's reauthorization. Just on that point, I'll come back to it toward the end of my remarks, but the Higher Education Act was last reauthorized in 2008, and I think that there has been a fair amount of bipartisan support for reauthorizing the act in the coming year or in the next couple of years. I think there's a sense that it's overdue, and that is something that the 115th Congress would like to address. So we may see a number of these regulations addressed in that context as well. In addition, the Trump administration could refuse to enforce the regulation, or it could initiate a new rulemaking. It could also attempt to enforce the regulation in some narrower form. And, because this is such a sprawling rule with so many provisions, there are ways that certain parts of it, I think, could be enforced and others not enforced. There are also some ongoing procedural rules that are connected with the borrower defense to repayment rule, having to do with the form of the disclosures. And it's difficult to get much of a window into the Department of Education, but I would think that a lot of that ground to a halt at this point as a result of directives from the White House. If for some reason no action is taken on this rule, I do think it is a rule that is kind of ripe for challenge because it has very many very problematic provisions in it. So just moving on to one, to the gainful employment rule, which is a few years old and probably the one that has been the subject of the most coverage in the Obama administration. Just by way of setting up this rule, the Higher Education Act itself, the statute, requires schools that receive Title IV funding to provide a, quote, program of training to prepare students for gainful employment in a recognized, end quote, occupation or profession. So the language gainful employment is in the statute. What happened in the Obama administration is that the Department of Education decided to interpret that gainful employment language in a rulemaking. And in particular, to condition the receipt of Title IV funds on schools providing, and this is from the final rule, quote, education and training to their students that lead to earnings that will allow students to pay back their student loan debts. And this would be how to calculate this. This would be in accordance with metrics that the Department of Education has devised. So schools that fail to meet the debt-to-earnings metrics for multiple years would, in theory, possibly lose Title IV funding and may be required to warn students that they could lose, that the students could lose their federal funding. So this rule came out several years ago, and APSCU, as I had mentioned, brought a facial challenge to the rule on several grounds. One of them was that the Higher Education Act did not authorize the department to condition Title IV eligibility in this way, that the metrics are arbitrary and irrational, and that the results depend on student choices and economic conditions, that the department chose an arbitrary threshold for an acceptable amount of income that should go to debt servicing, and that the requirements of notice to students and certifications to the government are arbitrary and capricious. So this challenge was brought in the district court for the District of Columbia. The challenge was rejected by the district court, and as I had mentioned earlier, it went up to the D.C. Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit affirmed the district court's judgment. So, and that was early last year. So the rule is currently in effect and being implemented. Now, of course, the chief criticism of this rule, there are many criticisms of this rule, but again, it's just another example of the Obama administration's general hostility toward for-profit higher education, because the rule has a disproportionate impact on proprietary schools of higher education. And in particular, the school also requires sort of inappropriate comparisons between career-focused proprietary schools and more traditional institutions of higher education. The schools are very different in their focus, those different types of schools, and serve very different groups of students for different purposes. And yet the rule kind of lumps everyone together and draws inappropriate comparisons. Schools that are in low-earning geographic areas and geographic regions are inherently disadvantaged under these rules, and the rule will eventually lead to reduced options and for non-traditional students and students in certain geographic areas who seek out career-focused education at proprietary institutions of higher education. So the current status of the rule is that on January 9th of this year, the Department of Education released its debt-to-earnings results. They've published them. And the headline, predictably, for the data that came out was that more than 800 career training programs at for-profit schools failed the department's debt-to-earning threshold of an annual loan payment that is at least greater than 30% of discretionary income and greater than 12% of total earnings. And in its release, the department specifically called out for-profit programs for not providing their graduates with a, quote, reasonable return on investment. So it really did seem to validate a lot of the concerns of the sector when this data came out. And significantly, schools had no opportunity to see these results or to challenge the department's statistics before the public release of the data. SIKU, which is the successor of ABSCU, has identified errors in the data, publicly identified it, and criticized the publication of the data before the so-called failing schools had exhausted the Department of Education appeals process. And just a few days ago, reporting that more than 200 colleges have given the Department of Education notice that they will appeal their gainful employment scores. So quite a lot is happening with this rule, and a lot, as I say, a lot has been happening to validate the concerns of the sector with this rule. So predictions, it's a number of options are in theory available for dealing with the gainful employment rule. It is, because it was enacted or promulgated a few years ago, it is well outside the period under the Congressional Review Act. But GOP congressional leaders have reportedly identified this rule as one they will seek to roll back in some form in the new session. In the meantime, it appears that schools are generally complying with the regulation, but it is, in theory, schools can bring as-applied challenges. One can speculate that some of the agency appeals that are starting up now could eventually lead to litigation for these metrics numbers that have been calculated. I think it's safe to say that the sector would very much like to see this rule rescinded in some way. Again, for all of the reasons, the criticisms that I've mentioned, the metrics skew very heavily against proprietary schools that serve non-traditional students and programs in low-wage and rural areas. So I think that this is one that we're very likely to see some further action on. It may also be encompassed within the Higher Education Act reauthorization that I mentioned and we'll come back to shortly. Finally, the last rule, which I'll just cover briefly, is the incentive compensation rule. And in this one, basically what happened was the Department of Education eliminated a safe harbor that permitted compensating college recruiters based on certain graduation and completion rates, and it amended its regulations to ban that compensation. There were some successful legal challenges brought to the elimination of that safe harbor, and the result of which was that the Department of Education has admitted that it lacks sufficient evidence to demonstrate that schools are using graduation-based or completion-based compensation as a proxy for enrollment-based compensation. So it therefore reinterpreted its rule not to prohibit compensation for recruiters based on students' graduation from or completion of educational programs. Not a lot has been said about this rule in recent months. I've not seen a lot of reporting on it. It suggests that the sector is generally complying with the rule, and I've, again, not seen much discussion on it. The sector, I think, would probably like to see a return to the regulatory safe harbor that was in the initial rule, but again, I've not seen much discussion of that either. The most significant issue that relates to incentive compensation is something called the Hansen Memo. The Hansen Memo, so just by way of background here, in 2002, Deputy Secretary Bill Hansen issued a memorandum expressing the department's view that a school's violation of the incentive compensation prohibition does not result in monetary loss to the department. And the quote was, "Improper recruiting does not render a recruited student ineligible to receive student aid funds for attendance at the institution on whose behalf the recruiting is conducted. The appropriate sanction for a violation," the memo concluded, "was a fine, essentially. And that guidance, the reason why that guidance was very important to the sector was because schools often find themselves defending False Claims Act lawsuits. And schools' program participation agreements with the department typically require schools to certify that they are in compliance with all applicable regulations. QTAM regulators often will seek treble damages for minor regulatory infractions, but there's no basis for such demands if the government has suffered no monetary loss. So it was the Hansen memo was a very significant piece of guidance for that purpose. But predictably, I think in 2015 the Department of Education reversed course. It withdrew the Hansen memo, and it declared that a violation of incentive compensation prohibition does cause monetary loss to the department. And in such cases, according to the 2015 guidance, an institution is liable to the department for the cost of the funds received. So now schools that violate the incentive compensation rule could potentially be liable for treble the cost of Title IV funds that are received. It's something that I think the sector is very much alive to, and I think that we may very well see something like a return of the Hansen memo. Of course, it would be, you know, in a different form, but I think that is something that is easily accomplished by the Trump administration, and it would not require any action by Congress. So I would imagine that is something that we could see. And just in final, before we open it up to questions, just a couple of remarks on the Higher Education Act reauthorization. Many of the problems I've discussed today could be addressed through the Higher Education Act reauthorization, which, as I said, last occurred in 2008. The chairs of both the Senate and House Education Committees have expressed interest in overhauling the HEA and the new Congress. And in 2015, a bipartisan congressional task force issued a report called Recalibrating Regulation of Colleges and Universities that called specific attention to the over-complexity of federal regulations governing institutions of higher education and the skyrocketing costs of burdens of compliance. So I think it is a ripe environment for further action by Congress to overhaul a lot of the regulation that is really dragging down the sector and to streamline it. I mean, if you're a proprietary school that is that has issued stock, you could find yourself under just at the federal level under regulation by the SEC, the CFPB, the Federal Trade Commission, the Department of Education, the Department of Defense. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of regulation. So there is a real sense, it seems, and a bipartisan sense, perhaps, that there is something that could be done for streamlining and really just reducing this regulation. And I think that's very much consistent with what we see coming out of the Trump administration. So that just covers my prepared remarks. And I think at this point, Nate, if you are with us, if you could just open it up to any questions that we may have.
Sure, happy to do so. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. One programming note, our next telephone conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, the 8th, at 1 p.m. That call is titled Pending Litigation and the New Administration. We will have with us Stephen G. Bradbury, who is a partner at Deckard LLP, and William Consovoy, who is a partner at Consovoy McCarthy Park PLLC. Currently, the question queue is wide open. If you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. Lucas, one of the questions I had was actually with regard to some of the earlier rules from the Department of Education during the Obama administration, and just your thoughts on those cases and whether or not they illustrate problems with Chevron deference.
That is a great question. Yes, I think that full disclosure, my law firm was participating in some of the earlier challenges that we discussed. Just full disclosure there. And of course, I'm not speaking for anyone who was involved in that litigation, but I do think that Chevron deference does seem like an issue that is going to come under scrutiny in a number of ways. First of all, with the nomination of Judge Gorsuch, he has been very outspoken on the question of the level of deference we should give to agencies. And I think we're going to see some discussion in his confirmation hearings. I would not be surprised to see it at all about this issue. And in fact, I believe there's also been legislation introduced in Congress essentially put limits on, I believe Goodlatte has introduced some legislation that would put limits on the amount of agency deference that we're likely to see. And I think it's something that's a very valid criticism in many of these cases. I think, and it's something that I think the sector is very much alive to as well in some of the dealings that it's had with Department of Education regulations. My sense is that we're going to see much more of this, and that in some instances courts have afforded too much deference to agency action. But I think it's something that we're going to see, as I say, we'll see much more of in the coming months.
Okay, very good. Again, a reminder to our audience, if you would like to join the question queue, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing Teleforum calls. You can consult our full schedule of upcoming Teleforum calls at the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Lucas, I don't see any more questions. Are there some additional comments you'd like to offer for us today?
The only additional comments I would mention are that, I focused on notice and comment rules that came out of the last administration. There have been a number of less formal regulatory and administrative actions that came out of the Obama administration. Things such as presidential memoranda, President Obama had issued a number of presidential memoranda that touched on the higher education sector and for-profit education in particular. I believe there was also, in the last administration, there was an interagency task force set up led by Undersecretary Ted Mitchell. And not a lot has been reported on the task force publicly, but it was reported that it included the Department of Justice, the Defense Department, Treasury, Veterans Affairs, the Labor Department, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Federal Trade Commission, the IRS, the SEC, and even coordination with state attorneys general. Some of these things, I think, are much easier for the Trump administration to address if it's inclined to do that, because these are executive branch type informal agency action, informal action within the executive branch. And so I think wholly apart from the specific notice and comment rules that I had mentioned, I think we are likely to see some quiet action on some of these other informal policies and regulatory guidance from the Department of Education and other units within the executive branch. So I think that was my only other observation for this topic.
Well, excellent. I will issue a final call for questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. Lucas, I don't see anyone else join the queue. It seems like you've been very comprehensive on this issue, and we appreciate your willingness to join us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Lucas Townsend for speaking with us today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.